And you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. That's right, folks. We're back on the airwaves air again at 101.3 FM and streaming live at freakradio.org, www.freakradio.org. Go to the main page and follow the instructions to pick up the free streaming link. This is the Mideast Migraines Radio Show. This is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren Tawil, on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, as we usually do, and we are streaming live and free at freakradio.org. Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, November the 3rd, 2014. It's 3:06 in the afternoon, and if all that time and date stuff jives with your own personal time-space continuum, then you know that the show is live, so you may call in any time to this live show. The phone number Directly to the studio here is area code for the area of Santa Cruz County, California, on the Central Coast here. Area code 831-427-3772. Again, the phone number, area 831-427-3772. 427-3772. 2 days ago, I was finishing up a little short booklet, an anthology actually, paperback anthology published by Jewish Voice for Peace from some 10 years ago, published in 2004. The title was Reframing Anti-Semitism, Alternative Jewish Perspectives. Yep, I just looked at the book. That's what it was called. Eight fairly short chapters, or articles actually, forming the chapters of this edited book, all by Jewish authors. And if you missed any of those readings, you can go to the archives for Mideast Migraines on two separate websites. One is Santa Cruz Indie Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y. Santa Cruz Indie Bay. Indie Bay provides opportunities free of charge for writers and program producers and various other people who are looking for outlets for their work and to pass along their work. Indie Bay, as I said, has, of course, its Santa Cruz website. There's one for San Francisco and I believe a few others, perhaps all within California. At any rate, I can only publish on the Santa Cruz Indie Bay site. That's where you will find my programs archived going back to a certain date. But for several months now, I've been archiving on Santa Cruz Indie Bay. Go to Santa Cruz Indie Bay, click on Palestine, or just check the long box, long as in the length of the entire web page, on the right hand side, the green box on the right margin. Scroll down to find the latest Mideast Migraines recorded shows. Now, for a more concise listing of all three of the programs that it took for me to read Reframing Anti-Semitism, Alternative Jewish Perspectives, you want to go to a second website, radioforall.net, and that's radio, R-A-D-I-O, the digital character for, A-L-L.N-E-T, radioforall.net, radioforall.net. Type in Mideast Migraines. The way I spell migraines has two I's in it. And you will find the chronological listing of my shows, the most recent, if not the most recent, recently broadcasted one, at least the most recent one that I have put up on that archive. At any rate, you should be able to recognize those shows that contain the readings of Reframing Anti-Semitism, as well as Paul Finley's They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby, and even before that, going back, readings dating back to a year ago, November of 2013, I began and eventually completed, over the course of about half a year, every chapter, every word of Max Blumenthal's Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Those are up there at radioforall.net. Two, and maybe some of them are up on the Indie Base site. I only began putting my shows, I began archiving on Santa Cruz Indie Bay well after I began using the radioforall.net website. Okay, that's how you do your catching up there. As far as those are concerned, the thing is, I promised last Saturday that I would continue to stay on the subject of Zionism and perhaps anti-Semitism. So I've searched my own personal archives, and I've come up with this fascinating piece, Fraud Fit for a King, Israel, Zionism, and the Misuse of MLK, referring, of course, to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Fraud Fit for a King, Israel, Zionism, and the Misuse of Martin Luther King, the junior one, not the father. This is the actual, you see, okay, this is a single article, and if I have time and if I see fit, I will read a kind of an addendum string of articles to this from zmag.org. Zmag.org. Published as a ZNet commentary, January 21, 2003, folks, we're going back quite a ways, January 21, 2003, from ZMag, author unknown. Rarely am I considered insufficiently cynical, as someone who does, and I'm reading from the article now, rarely am I considered insufficiently cynical. As someone who does anti-racism work for a living and hears all manner of excuse making by those who wish to avoid being considered racist, not much surprises me. I expect people to lie about race, to swear they haven't a racist bone in their bodies. And every January, with the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday around the corner, I have come to expect someone to misuse the good doctor's words so as to push an agenda he would not likely have supported. As such, I long ago resigned myself to the annual gaggle of fools who use King's, quote, content of their character, end quote, line from the 1963 March on Washington so as to attack affirmative action, ostensibly because King preferred simple, quote, colorblindness. That King actually supported the efforts that we now call affirmative action. Remembering, folks, this article is from 11 years ago, 2003, almost 12 years ago. That King actually supported the efforts that we now call affirmative action, and even billions in reparations. As I've documented previously, matters not to these folks. They've never read King's work, and they've only paid attention to one news clip from one speech, and even then didn't understand what they were hearing. Yet, even with my cynic's credentials established, the one thing I never expected anyone to do would be to make up a quote from King. And then this author here writes the following in bold letters. A quote he simply never said, and claimed that it came from a letter that he never wrote, and was published in a collection of his essays that never existed. Continuing with the bold type, frankly, this level of deception is something special. Back to regular standard, plain-faced characters now, plain-faced writing. I'm fiddling with my telephone here. Make sure I hear any phone calls that come in. Okay, continuing now with this article. The hoax of which I speak is one currently making the rounds on the internet, which claims to prove King's steadfast support for Zionism. Indeed, it does more than that. In the item entitled Letter to an Anti-Zionist Friend, King proclaims that criticism of Zionism is tantamount to anti-Semitism and likens those who criticize Jewish nationalism as manifested in Israel to those who would seek to trample the rights of blacks. Heady stuff and 100% bullshit, as any amateur fact-checker would ascertain were they so inclined. But of course, folks who push an ideology that required expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians from their lands and then lied about it, claiming there had been no such persons to begin with, as with Golda Meir's infamous quip, can't be expected to place a very high premium on truth. I learned this the hard way recently when the Des Moines, Iowa, Jewish Federation succeeded in getting me yanked from the city's MLK Day events. Two speeches I had been scheduled to give on behalf of the National Conference of Community and Justice, the NCCJ, because of my criticisms of Israel and because I, as a Jew, am on record opposing Zionism philosophically, the Des Moines Shtetl, S-H-T-E-T-L, in English alliteration, the Des Moines Shtetl decided I was unfit to speak. After sending the supposed king quote around and threatening to pull out all monies from the Jewish community for future NCCJ events, I was dropped. The attack was based on a distortion of my own beliefs as well. Federation head Mark Finkelstein, this would be Mark Finkelstein, claimed I had shown a disregard for the well-being of Jews, despite my argument that Zionism has made world Jewry less safe than ever. But it was his duplicity, on King's views that was most disturbing. Though Finkelstein, Mark Finkelstein, only recited one line from King's supposed, quote, letter on Zionism, he lifted it from the larger letter, which appeared to have originated with Rabbi Mark Schneier, who quotes it in his book, Share Dreams, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Jewish Community. Therein one finds such over-the-top rhetoric as this, and I quote here, I say, let the truth ring forth from the high mountaintops. Let it echo through the valleys of God's green earth. When people criticize Zionism, they mean Jews. This is God's own truth. End quote. The letter also was filled with grammatical errors that any halfway literate reader of King's work should have known disqualified him from being its author. To wit, quote, anti-Zionist is inherently anti-Semitic and ever will be so, end quote. The treatise was supposedly published on page 76 of the August 1967 edition of Saturday Review and also appeared in the collection of his work entitled This I Believe, Selections from the Writings of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. That the claimants never mentioned the publisher of this collection should have been a clear tip-off that it might not be genuine, and indeed it is not. The book doesn't exist. As for Saturday Review, there are four issues in August of 1967. Two of them had a page 76. One of the pages 76 contains classified ads, and the other contained a review of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album. No King letter anywhere. Not on page 76, 67, 7, or 6, or anywhere else for that matter. Yet its lack of authenticity hasn't prevented it from having a long shelf life. Not only does it pop up in the Schneier book, but sections of it were read by the Anti-Defamation League's Michael Sahlberg in testimony before a House subcommittee in July of 2001. And all manner of pro-Israel groups, from traditional Zionists to right-wing Likudites to Christians who support ingathering Jews to Israel so as to prompt Jesus' return, all those have used the piece on their websites. In truth, King appears never to have made any public comment about Zionism per se, and the only known statement he ever made on the topic, made privately to a handful of people, is a far cry from what he is purported to have said in the so-called letter. In 1968, according to Seymour Martin Lipset, whose claim to this effect has also never been corroborated. King was in Boston and attended a dinner in Cambridge, along with Lipset himself and a number of black students. After dinner, a young man harshly attacked Zionists as people, to which King responded. Am I reading that right? Let me read it one more time. After dinner, a young man harshly attacked Zionists as people, to which King responded, "Don't talk like that. When people criticize Zionists, they mean Jews. You're talking anti-Semitism." And please forgive the slight pauses here. I'm trying to set things up here so I can view everything that's viewable. Okay. Okay. You're talking about this. Okay. Continuing now. Assuming this quote to be genuine, it is far from the ideological endorsement of Zionism evidenced in the phony letter. After all, to respond to a harsh statement about individuals who are Zionists with the warning that such language is usually a cover-up for anti-Jewish bias is understandable. More than that, the comment was no doubt true for most, especially in 1968. It is a statement of opinion as to what people are thinking when they say nothing. It is a statement of opinion as to what people are thinking when they say something. It is not a statement as to the validity of a worldview. Likewise, consider the following analogous dualism. First, that, quote, opposition to welfare programs is forever racism. And secondly, that, quote, when people criticize welfare recipients, they mean blacks. This is racism, end quote. Whereas the latter statement may be true, and studies suggest it is, the former is a matter of ideological conviction. Untestable, and thus more tendentious than its counterpart. In any event, as with the King quotes, both fabricated and genuine, the truth of the latter says nothing about the truth or falsity of the former. So yes, King was quick to admonish one person who expressed hostility to Zionists as people. But he did not claim that opposition to Zionism was inherently anti-Semitic. And for those who criticize Zionism today, and who, like me, are Jewish, to believe that we mean to attack Jews as Jews when we speak out against Israel and Zionism is absurd. As for King's position on Israel, it was quite limited. Meeting with Jewish leaders shortly before his death, Martin Luther King said that peace for Israelis and Arabs were important concerns. According to King, here's the quote, "Peace for Israel means security, and we must stand with all our might to protect its right to exist, its territorial integrity," end quote. But such a statement says nothing about how Israel would be constituted, nor addresses the Palestinians at all, whose lives were hardly on the world's radar screen in 1968. At the time, Israel's concern was a hostile Egypt. Reminding everyone, if I may interject here, 1968 was 1 year after the war, which Israel launched on its neighbors, which ended up bringing all of historic Palestine under Israel's control, including East Jerusalem, including the entire Sinai Peninsula, which belongs to rightfully to Egypt, and that small sliver of southwestern Syria we know as the Golan Heights. That was, the war was in 67. But such a statement says nothing about how Israel should be constituted, nor addresses the Palestinians at all, whose lives were hardly on the world's radar screen in 1968. At the time, Israel's concern was a hostile Egypt, and all would agree that any nation has the right not to be attacked by a neighbor. The U.S. has a right not to be attacked by the Soviets, too, as King would have agreed, thereby affirming the United States' quote-unquote right to exist. But would anyone claim that such a sentiment would have implied the right of the U.S. to exist as it did in 1957 under segregation? Of course not. So to Israel, its right to exist in the sense of not being violated... its right to exist in the sense of not being violently destroyed does not mean the right to exist as a Jewish state, as opposed to the state of all its citizens. It does not mean the right to laws granting special privileges to Jews from around the world over indigenous Arabs. It should also be noted that in the same paragraph where King reiterated his support for Israel's right to exist, he also proclaimed the importance of massive public assistance to Middle Eastern Arabs in the form of a Marshall Plan so as to counter the poverty and desperation that often leads to hostility and violence towards Israeli Jews. This part of King's position is typically ignored by the organized Jewish community, of course, even though it was just as important to King as Israel's territorial integrity. As for what King would say today about Israel, Zionism, and the Palestinian struggle, one can only speculate. After all, he died before the tragedy of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza would be able to unfold. He died before the invasion of Lebanon and the massacres at Sabra and Shatila, before the Intifada, the Palestinian Intifada, before Israel decided to serve as proxy for U.S. foreign policy, funneling weapons to fascist governments in South Africa, Argentina, and Guatemala, or arming terrorist thugs in Mozambique and the Contras in Nicaragua, before the proliferation of illegal settlements throughout the territories, before the rash of suicide bombings, before the polls showing that nearly half of Israeli Jews support removing Palestinians via, quote, transfer to neighboring countries. But one thing is certain. While King would no doubt condemn Palestinian violence against innocent civilians, he would also condemn the state violence of Israel. He would condemn missile attacks against entire neighborhoods in order to flush out a handful of wanted terrorists. He would oppose handing out machine guns to religious fanatics in Brooklyn who moved to the territories and proclaim their God-given right to the land and the right to run Arabs out of their neighborhoods or discriminate against them in a multitude of ways. He would oppose the unequal rationing of water resources between Jews and Arabs. That is Israeli policy. He would oppose the degrading checkpoints through which Palestinian workers must pass to get to their jobs or back to their homes after a long day of work. He would oppose the policy that allows IDF officers to shoot children throwing rocks as young as age 12. In other words, Martin Luther King would likely criticize the working out of Zionism on the ground as it is actually developed in the real world, as opposed to the world of theory and speculation. These things seem eminently clear from any honest reading of his work or examination of his life. He would be a broker for peace. And it is a tragedy that instead of King himself, we are burdened with charlatans like those at the ADL, the Jewish Anti-Defamation League, or the Des Moines Jewish Federation, or rabbis like Mark Schneier, who think nothing of speaking for the genuine article in a voice not his own. End of article. Fraud fit for a king. Israel, Zionism, and the misuse of MLK. from zmag.org. January 21, 2003, published as a ZNet commentary. Just for fun, let me click on the link for ZMag. See if it's still in existence. It says, sorry! If you are the owner of this website, please contact your hosting provider. It's at webmaster@zmag.org. The IP address has changed. Just remember, this is an 11-year-old article. 11-year-old article that I just read to you. The IP address for this domain may have changed recently. It says here, check your DNS settings to verify that the domain is set up correctly. It may take 8 to 24 hours for DNS changes to propagate. There has been a server misconfiguration. Okay, well, maybe there is no more ZMag anymore, which leads me to believe that there's no more webmaster for ZMag. I just wanted to check that out. But I do not believe the existence or non-existence effective, what happens when something falls into disuse or is no longer, whether or not there is any more a ZMag or ZMag.org, it's still a fascinating article. And it sounds like this guy did his homework to establish the falseness of this quotation, or at least the minimalization of any comments that Martin Luther King may have made, supposedly making an absolute connection between Zionism, or between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. Okay, this is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren Tawil. It is 3:33 in the afternoon, this Monday, November 3rd, 2014. This program comes to you every Monday at 3 in the afternoon. Pacific Standard Time. We're now in Standard Time, PST, but with the same starting time. Of course, the earlier mentioned weekend edition of Mideast Migraines, a completely separate show in terms of content, but still produced by yours truly here, comes every Saturday starting at 11 o'clock in the morning. Both shows are entitled Mideast Migraines, although I like to sort of embellish the book reading weekly show on Saturday as the Saturday or weekend edition. So we have Mideast Migraines on Saturday at 11 and every Monday at 3 o'clock. Ah, folks, let's talk about this latest hubbub about Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. I picked this up simply from the MSN news reporting sort of main page to whoever uses a browser that's populated primarily by MSN. Additional reporting by Matt Spitalnik in Washington. Editing by Dan Williams and Dominic Evans from MSN. This is from just a few days ago. Israel's Netanyahu fumes at reported U.S. slur. Here are the basic facts as reported by MSN. From Jerusalem, or in Jerusalem, an anonymous United States officials reported description of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as a, quote, chicken shit or worthless coward drew a sharp response on Wednesday from the Israeli leader. No stranger to acrimony from the Obama administration. The American broadside, in an interview in the Atlantic magazine, followed a month of heated exchanges between the Netanyahu government of Israel and Washington over settlement building in Israeli annex East Jerusalem, which Palestinians seek as the capital of a future state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The thing about BB is he's a chicken shit, the unidentified official was quoted as saying. Using Netanyahu's nickname, BB, and a slang insult certain to redden the ears of the U.S.-educated former commando. To redden the ears, I believe that's an expression meaning a lot of people are talking about you. Quote, the good thing about Netanyahu is that he's scared to launch wars, the official said, alluding to past hints of possible Israeli military action against Iran's nuclear program. He continues to say here, the bad thing about him is that he won't do anything to reach an accommodation with the Palestinians or with the Sunni Arab states. End quote. Netanyahu, the official was reported to have said, is interested only in, quote, protecting himself from political defeat. He's got no guts. Israeli leaders usually do not respond to comments by unidentified officials. But Netanyahu addressed those remarks directly in opening a memorial ceremony in parliament for an Israeli cabinet minister assassinated by a Palestinian back in 2001. Which, this paragraph leads me to wonder, if it's true that Israeli leaders usually do not respond to comments by unidentified officials, could that at all be a leading reason for the United States not to identify these officials, is because they don't want to hear comments from Israeli leaders? I can't help but wonder about that. Continuing with the article, Netanyahu said, our supreme interests, chiefly the security and unity of Jerusalem, are not the main concern of those anonymous officials who attack us and me personally, as the assault on me comes only because I defend the state of Israel. End quote. He also said the following, despite all of the attacks I suffer, I will continue to defend our country. I'll continue to defend the citizens of Israel. Such pledges by Netanyahu have resonated among Israeli voters, even amid fears his strained relations with U.S. President Barack Obama could ultimately weaken support from Israel's main diplomatic ally and arms provider. After Netanyahu's speech, Alistair Baskey, a spokesman for the White House National Security Council, dismissed the purported slur, denying that it reflected how the Obama administration felt about the Israeli leader. He said, quote, certainly that's not the administration's view, and we think such comments are inappropriate and counterproductive, end quote. Some Israeli pundits predict an Israeli election in 2015... 2 years earlier, some Israeli pundits predict an Israeli election in 2015, 2 years earlier, speculation seemingly supported by increasingly vocal challenges to his policies from senior ministers to the left and right of him within the coalition government. That's a weird paragraph. I think something is wrong with it. Continuing, Economy Minister Naftali Bennett, whose ultranationalist Jewish Home Party belongs to the coalition, but who has had testy relations with Netanyahu, defended him on Wednesday. Bennett said this, the Prime Minister of Israel is not a private person. He is the leader of the Jewish state and the entire Jewish people. Cursing the Prime Minister and calling him names is an insult, not just to him, but to the millions of Israeli citizens and Jews across the globe. Naftali Bennett wrote that in Facebook. Subheading, friction. Israeli opposition leader Isaac Herzog sounded a more critical note, telling Channel 2 television, Netanyahu is acting like a political pyromaniac, and he has brought our relations with the United States to an unprecedented low, end quote. In a series of recent speeches widely seen in Israel as setting the stage for a possible poll, Netanyahu has highlighted growing security concerns in the wake of the July-August war with Hamas in Gaza and regional unrest that has brought Islamist militants to Israel's northern border with Syria. Has highlighted growing security concerns. Israel also worries that U.S.-led world powers will agree to what it deems insufficient curbs on the nuclear program of its arch foe, Iran, in talks with a looming November 24 deadline. Israel. Fears of a possible new Palestinian intifada or uprising have been stoked in Israel by now daily rock-throwing by Palestinians in Jerusalem amid Muslim fears of an end to an Israeli de facto ban on Jewish worship at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the holy city where biblical temples once stood. Netanyahu has pledged to preserve the, quote, status quo at the site, a commitment Palestinian leaders view with suspicion. But drawing Palestinian outrage and a State Department accusation that Israel was distancing peace, Netanyahu pledged on Monday to fast-track plans for 1,000 new settler homes in Israeli-annexed East Jerusalem. Netanyahu describes his criticism as being, quote, detached from reality, saying Jews had a right to live anywhere in Jerusalem, regarded by Israel as its united capital, a claim not internationally recognized. Baski, the U.S. spokesman, acknowledged longstanding policy differences between Israel and Washington over settlements. Obviously, despite the extremely close relationship between the U.S. and Israel, we do not agree on every issue, he said. Baski added this, for instance, we have repeatedly made clear the United States' longstanding view that settlement activity is illegitimate and complicates efforts to achieve a two-state solution, end quote. Despite these differences, quote, the U.S.-Israel relationship remains as strong as ever. Most countries and the world court deem the settlements Israel has built in areas captured in a 1967 war to be illegal. Israel disputes this and has settled 500,000 Jews in East Jerusalem and the West Bank among 2.4 million Palestinians. Okay, those are the facts and the various reported comments concerning this chicken shit remark. That word, that expletive used to describe the Prime Minister of Israel, said by a U.S. official, unnamed U.S. official. Okay, now, this came in just yesterday, November 2nd. This is, it's from GushShalom.org. GushShalom is an Israeli peace-oriented organization, Gush Shalom. Here is Yuri Avneri's column. Yuri Avneri is an old, previously Zionist Jew. I doubt that he considers himself to be a Zionist anymore, whose history with the Israel state goes way back. He's probably a native of that country, although he would have been born long before 1948, when the modern state of Israel came into being. So I'm inferring that he probably was born in a Jewish settlement amongst Jews in Palestine. Yuri Avneri. Here is Yuri Avneri's column of November 1st, actually, entitled, interestingly enough, Chicken Shit. Listen to this guy. When a high-ranking official of one country calls the leader of another country chicken shit, it must be assumed... Oh, boy. I'm going to have to change. I'm afraid I won't be able to either. I'm having difficulty here because I cannot read. Oh, here. Okay, I think it'll work now. I think I can read all the words. When a high-ranking official of one country calls the leader of another country chicken shit, quote-unquote, it may be assumed that the relations between the two countries are not at their best. In fact, they may be considered somewhat less than cordial. Grab some lovely cool beverage here. My throat does tire. I mean, you try doing a straight through 2-hour program for all to hear behind the microphone. Continuing. As I said, in fact, they may be, the relations between the two countries may be considered somewhat less than cordial. This week, it happened. An unnamed, very high-ranking U.S. official said this is an interview. This week it happened. An unnamed, very high-ranking U.S. official said this. The word chicken shit. In an interview with a respected American journalist who bears the very Jewish name of Jeffrey Goldberg. No high-ranking official would use such a term for publication without the express permission of the President of the United States of America. So here we are. History has seen many strange relationships between nations, but I dare say none stranger than that existing between Israel and the U.S. On the face of it, no two states could be closer to each other. Just a minor example. The day the memorable chicken shit remark made headlines, the General Assembly of the United Nations adopted a resolution calling upon the U.S. to put an end to its 50-year-old embargo on Cuba. 188 countries, including the whole spectrum of European Union and NATO countries, voted in favor. Two states voted against, the U.S. and Israel. That's the minor example. Two countries against the entire world? No, not entirely. Micronesia, Palau, and the Marshall Islands abstain. Those are all tiny island countries in the Pacific Ocean. He says parenthetically here, these three mighty island nations generally support Israel too, though few Israelis could place them on the map. Throughout the years and hundreds of UN votes, Israel has stood loyally with the U.S. and vice versa. An unshakable alliance, so it seemed. And now they call our valiant Prime Minister chicken shit? The official based his uncomplimentary remark on Benjamin Netanyahu's disinclination to bomb Iran, as threatened repeatedly, as well as on Netanyahu's unwillingness to make peace with the Palestinians. The first accusation is unfounded, since Netanyahu never seriously considered an attack on Iran. Some of my readers may remember that from the first day I assured them that such an attack would not happen without even leaving myself a loophole in case I might be wrong. I knew that such an attack was quite out of the question, and not only because the entire Israeli defense establishment was against it. The second accusation is even more groundless. Netanyahu did not chicken out of making peace. This would presuppose that he wanted peace in the first place. If the Americans really believe so, they should read a few good articles, especially mine, referring to Yuri Avneri. I have a confession to make when I'm done with this article. Okay, the second accusation is even more groundless. Netanyahu did not chicken out of making peace. This would presuppose that he wanted peace in the first place. If the Americans really believe so, they should read a few good articles, especially mine. Netanyahu never entertained, even for a moment, the idea of making peace. His entire upbringing makes this quite impossible. His late father, Ben Zion, was such an extreme and rigid nationalist that compared him to Vladimir Jabotinsky, the Zionist right-wing leader, looked like a leftist pacifist. Continuing. Every word Benjamin Netanyahu has ever uttered in favor of peace and the two-state solution was a blatant lie. For him to advocate a Palestinian state is like the chief rabbi advocating eating pork on Yom Kippur. Any American diplomat who does not know this should be transferred at once to Micronesia or Palau. Lately, it seems that Netanyahu has been doing everything in his power to provoke a quarrel with the U.S. government. At first sight, this looks like an act of lunacy, an act so dangerous that any competent psychiatrist would commit him to the closed wing of an asylum. Israel is totally dependent on the United States, not 99%, but 100%. On the very same day as the publication of the chicken shit statement, the U.S. agreed to sell Israel a second squadron of F-35 fighter planes after the sale of the first 19 planes, which costs $2.35 billion. The money comes from the yearly tribute the U.S. pays to Israel. Flesh that out a little here. What he means by that, of course, the U.S. pays to Israel refers to the fact that Israel is at the very top of the military foreign aid list of the United States government. Foreign military aid, Israel has been for many years now, receiving more than anyone else, some $3.5 billion every year. Generally allotted in 10-year promised segments. And, of course, that money actually comes from the United States taxpayer. That's what he's talking about. Now, continuing with the article. Without the automatic U.S. veto and all U.N. Security Council resolutions not approved by the Israeli government, there would have long been a state of Palestine as a full-fledged member of the U.N. I believe he means there would have long ago been a state of Palestine as a full-fledged member of the United Nations, a cornerstone of our foreign relations, is the belief of many countries that in order to gain entrance to the favors of the U.S. Congress, they first need to bribe the gatekeeper, Israel, and so on. Literally every Israeli is convinced that our relationship with the U.S. is the lifeline of the state. By our relationship, he's referring to Israel's relationship. Literally every Israeli is convinced that our relationship with the United States is the lifeline of the state. If there is anything at all on which Israelis of all age groups, communities, beliefs, and political orientations are unanimous, it is this conviction. So how come our Prime Minister is working full-time on destroying the relationship between the two governments? When our Minister of Defense, Moshe Yaalon, visited Washington, D.C. this week, all his requests to meet U.S. cabinet ministers and other high officials were categorically refused, except for a meeting with his colleague, Chuck Hagel, who could not very well object. It was an unprecedented open insult. Yaalon, a former chief of staff of the army, the Israeli army, is not considered a genius. Some believe that it would have been better if he had stayed at his former profession, milking cows in a kibbutz. When he declared that John Kerry suffered from and, quote, obsessive messianism or obsessive messianism. In his efforts to achieve peace between Israel and Palestine, both Kerry and President Barack Obama were deeply offended. But such statements by Israeli cabinet ministers have become routine. So have the sharp rebuttals of official U.S. spokesmen and spokeswomen. These are ignored by the Israeli public. Benjamin Netanyahu is no fool. Chicken shit or not, unlike Yaalon, he is considered smart and intelligent. So what is he doing? There is a method in his madness. Netanyahu grew up in the United States. When his father was boycotted by Israeli academia, which refused to take him seriously as a historian, the family moved to a suburb of Philadelphia. Benjamin prides himself on having an intimate knowledge of the U.S. What is he thinking about? He knows that Israel controls the U.S. Congress. Remember, folks, this is Israeli Jewish columnist Yuri Avneri talking here. He knows that Israel controls the U.S. Congress. No American politician could possibly be reelected if he voiced even the slightest hint of criticism of the, quote, Jewish state. AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the most powerful lobby in Washington, apart from the National Rifle Association, will see to that. The powerful grip the Jewish lobby has on the media is a further guarantee. In Netanyahu's view, in any confrontation between Congress and the White House over Israel, the president is bound to lose. So there is nothing to be afraid of. Netanyahu, in fact, is playing roulette with all the capital of Israel in the vast casino called the United States of America. Perhaps he has been infected by his mentor and protector, the casino czar Sheldon Adelson, who has a hand in conducting Israeli policy in the U.S. And parenthetically, Avneri writes, it was Adelson who appointed the Israeli ambassador in Washington, Ron Dremmer, a prominent activist of the Republican Party, who is detested by the White House. Close parentheses. In order to appreciate the magnitude of Netanyahu's gamble with us as chips, with the Israeli people as chips, one has to visualize the State of the Union. The United States is now a dysfunctional democracy. In a normal democracy, say the United Kingdom or Germany, there are two central parties or party coalitions which face each other. They are both, quote, mainstream, and the differences between them are minor. They succeed each other from time to time without much ado. The citizens hardly notice. Not in the U.S., not anymore. The American public is now deeply divided between two camps, which hate each other from the bottom of their hearts, if they have any. This hatred is abysmal. One is the party of the ultra-rich, who defend their privileges. The other belongs to the moderately wealthy and serves their interests. The ideologies of the two camps are diametrically opposed. Therefore, they cannot agree practically on anything. Anything the Democrats do is considered almost treason by the Republicans. Anything the Republicans advocate is considered by the Democrats as stupid, if not crazy. The Republicans who control Congress, and may do so even more firmly in a few days' time, like tomorrow, folks, tomorrow, Tuesday, is general election day. The Republicans are out to immobilize the administration. Once they even stopped all federal payments, making the running of the state, once they even stopped all federal payments, making the running of the state impossible. A consistent joint foreign policy is out of the question. I am not sure that the situation on the eve of the Great Civil War was much worse. This, of course, referring to the American Civil War. Into this crazy situation, Netanyahu is plunged. He has placed all his chips, us, the Israelis, on the Republicans. During the last presidential elections, he almost openly supported Mitt Romney, the opponent of Obama, 2 years ago, thus practically declaring war on the present administration. The radical anti-Obama statements made now by Israeli leaders are used and designed to be used by Republican candidates against their Democratic opponents. The Democrats make strenuous efforts to woo Jewish voters and donors by flattering Israel in the most outrageous terms, promising to support each and every action of the Israeli government now and for all eternity, be it what it may. Inadvertently, they stick knives into the back of the Israeli peace forces, making the fight for peace even more Herculean. They stick knives. But even if the midterm elections make the House and the Senate even more subservient to the Israeli right wing, Obama will be around for 2 more years. In a way, having no more elections to fear, he will be freer than before to obstruct Netanyahu. I wish he would, but I do not entertain too much hope. Even as a lame duck, he will still have to consider the interests of the next Democratic candidate for the White House. Obama could still do a lot for peace between Israel and Palestine, a peace supported by the entire pro-American Arab bloc. Something clearly in the U.S. national interests, not to mention ours. For that, courage is needed. And yes, a little more obsessive messianism. Okay, this is pretty typical, quite clever and cleverly written Yuri Avneri stuff. And he does have a rather entertaining way with words, which were those words actually being right on. His tongue is stuck in his cheek so often that it sometimes is a little hard to tell when he's being a little too tongue-in-cheek, I guess. As for the confession I promised, when I was talking about my short biographical note of Yuri Avneri, I, alas, was thinking of Ilan Pappé. For some reason, I still get Avneri mixed up with Pappé when I see their name up in bright, shiny letters here on my screen. Although it may very well be true that Avneri was indeed born in Israel, and offhand, I would say he is roughly as old as the 66-and-a-half-year-old Jewish state of Israel. So he probably was born there, but since he is, his name is still revered amongst so many readers of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, as well as cursed by many readers of Haaretz, or those who now those good Jewish Zionists who now may refuse to read the newspaper. Offhand, I would guess that Avneri is still a Zionist, if not very ardently nationalistically, so much so anymore. Okay. Okay. Oh, I'm going to play a little bit of music here, and then we're going to have our Palestine Solidarity Telesummit interview.
Thank you.
And in case you've been wondering, not to mention the fact that this is generally a good idea for radio hosts to give credit to those who provide musical entertainment, what you've been listening to is the Greek oud. The oud, of course, being that sort of real fat version of the mandolin, the body part anyway, very large and round. The Europeans call it a lute, which is sort of a bastardization of the original term laoud, or oud, the Middle Eastern oud. But this is Greek-style oud, played by a Greek-American, Mavroti T. Kotanis. This last piece that you heard was number three here, Nikris Longa, which appears to have been composed by Mr. Kontanis. Before that, Mahur Sharki. Mahur Sharki sounds like an Arabic name here. Basmi Sizade Abdi Efendi. But then again, it could be Greek. And I began the show with, again, this is essentially a Greek music, Greek language in reference here. Tis Zenita Thias Oponos. Antonios Diamantidis, or Talgas. I'm just reading you what I got here, folks. The Greek oud. The album is called Wooden Heart, 2008. Made in USA. I saw him in a very informal conference at a friend's home in Ben Lomond. Okay, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz. Streaming live at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. And, of course, broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial. I'm eating a candy bar, so you'll have to put up with that influence on my ability to speak to you. Got to keep the old blood sugar highs. Dr. Michael here would agree with me, I'm sure.
Yeah, disagree. Poison.
Actually, admittedly, it's not a very good way of maintaining a high level of blood sugar. There are other ways. I know that. I'm not stupid. I might not be very disciplined or not have a lot of willpower, but I ain't stupid. So, the thing is, I had some PSAs that I felt obliged to pass along to you. Had them. All I need to do is find the right folder that I stuck them in. And I'm looking for those. No, of course they really... they really should be in my program preparation folder here, but I couldn't find them right off. But there really is such a thing as public service announcements for the radio. They're not jumping out at me. What happens is, folks, I tend to fill my Mideast Madness show prep folder, my MM prep folder, with things just to have for you in case I want to read them. I know I'm not going to be able to read everything, but I want to give myself the ability to jump around when I have them all right in front of me in a single column. Unfortunately, the downside of that is it tends to push down things like PSAs way towards the bottom of the list. So, alas, I just simply cannot readily find them. Sorry about that. Here's something. It's not exactly a PSA, but this is from the American Communist Party. The Communist Party USA, CPUSA, Radical Ideas, Real Politics. Countdown to Election Day. Let's see what they have to say about this. The Communists, American Communist Party's top 10 reasons to vote. Counting down from 10. 10, it's your right. Someone paid the price for your right to vote. Use it. Gee, a communist is actually saying that in so many words. Number 9, reason number 9 to to vote. It's your community, your neighbors, family, friends are depending on you. Someone believes in the right and the process of voting in this country. Number eight, it's your life. It started with it's your right, then it's your community. Now they're admitting it's your life. Even if politics seem far away from you, it affects your daily life. Number seven, it's your education. From school funding to college grants to job training, state and federal governments make budget decisions that have a direct impact on your ability to learn and earn. These are a bunch of commies talking. It sounds a little more like a TV commercial. Number six, it's your body. From policing to reproductive rights, the wrong government policies can literally cost you your life. Number five, it's your job. A raise in the minimum wage, pay equity, and the right to a union are all being decided now. Maybe instead of saying it's your job, they should say it's your livelihood. Number four, it's your environment. You can vote to invest in transportation and sustainable energy for our planet. Three, it's your retirement. Help make sure that Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and pension plans will be there for you. Two, it's your voice. Collective action starts with voting. Collective action starts with voting. Politicians listen to demands from communities with high turnout. I'm going to say that one more time, the whole thing. I think this is probably the most important. It's your voice. Collective action starts with voting. Politicians listen to demands from communities with high turnout. And interestingly, a major reason why Democrats very often lose certain elections is because, interestingly enough, Democrats have a higher rate of noncompliance, which means Democrats tend to have lower turnout than Republicans. The number one, top one reason to vote, number one, they want you to stay home. An attempt is underway to keep people from voting. Your vote can stop this election from being stolen. Resources to get out the vote and build the movement on the CPUSA election resource page. Okay. I knew I was saving that for a reason. It's 4:20 in the afternoon here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 4:20 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. No more daylight savings, at least for the next 6 months or so. Just the sun goes down more or less when it's supposed to. The sun's going to go down when it's supposed to anyway, when it wants to, regardless of what the clock says. The whole thing is artificial to begin with. Like a good Jewish friend of mine back in Minnesota says, it's all artificial anyway. It's application of numbers to the natural universe. Okay, my friends. Here's the thing. Last Monday, I began, and I made a promise out of this. Last Monday, I played the track from a video interview, video and audio interview, brought to us by the Palestine Solidarity Telesummit, a new service sponsored by Kate Miranda. I think that's right. Yeah, Katie Miranda. The first one that I played for you happened to be the very first one that she presented a couple of weeks ago in the series of telesummit interviews. That was with Mr. Remy Kanazi, a Palestinian-American born and raised in Massachusetts on the east coast of the U.S. of A. His parents were refugees when they lost their land and their ability to remain in their ancestral homeland of Palestine. Remy Kanazi became a stand-up comedian, as well as an author and a damn good informer of facts and opinion. That was a fascinating interview. The recording of that show, I just made available and put up on the two website, other website, other website archives that I mentioned to you earlier, radioforall.net and Santa Cruz Indie Bay. Just look for Remy Kanazi interview. Remy Kanazi, R-E-M-I, last name, K-A-N-A-Z-I. Remy Kanazi. That was last Monday. We're going to continue now, even though that happens to have been the first interview in Ms. Miranda's string of video interviews, as well as the first one I presented. I'm going to jump around a little. This one is only 3 or 4 days old. It is the Palestine Solidarity Telesummit interview with Rebecca Vilcomerson. And the original headline for my email that dropped that in my inbox said, "People are leaving J Street in droves, and Rebecca Vilcomerson explains why." Let me very quickly explain and identify J Street as a Zionist, pro-Zionist, pro-Israeli, left-wing organization of Americans which supports the two-state solution for Israel and Palestine. Interestingly, I do not support a two-state solution, not least of which because I know damn well it'll never happen. But I think that might say something about why Vilcomerson says that people are leaving J Street in droves. So let's just go ahead with this interview, and I hope it... Let me refresh the page just to make sure here. Oh, you're going to make me... Oh, it's going to make me sign in again, though. I mean, put the password in. Okay. Shouldn't be a problem. Sorry. Oh, really? Wait a minute. Let me concentrate here. Okay. I got the right password. Palestine Solidarity Telesummit interview with Rebecca Vilcomerson of Jewish Voice for Peace. Let's do this. With your host, Katie Miranda.
Hi, I'm here with Rebecca Vilcomerson, Executive Director of Jewish Voice for Peace. And Rebecca, so our listeners can have some context. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm in Brooklyn, New York. I've been a member of JVP since about 2001, 2002. That was when JVP was a much, much smaller organization. We were meeting in people's living rooms then in the Bay Area. We were only in the Bay Area. Now we have 65 chapters around the country. So we've had huge growth since that time, but I have been involved in the organization since then. I grew up in a Jewish home in the synagogue that my grandparents founded in New Jersey, and my husband is Israeli, and so we lived in Israel for 3 years, from 2006 to 2009. So I have that's my personal experience in the region.
Okay, great. So can you talk about your political evolution and how you began supporting Palestinian rights?
Yeah, I started to become political actually in Guatemala. In terms of overarching political awareness, I was there working with indigenous women's cooperatives shortly after the Guatemalan Civil War ended. That was in the mid-1990s. And that was where I sort of learned about the U.S. role in Guatemala and and by extension, the U.S. role in the world. And that sort of opened my eyes to a new political perspective that I hadn't learned about at all in school. And so when I returned from Guatemala, I sort of committed myself. I felt like it was important, even though I became politicized in Guatemala, I felt that it was important to focus on issues inside the United States. So I became an organizer defending welfare rights, doing housing and homelessness work, trying to eliminate homelessness and find housing for low-income people, overall economic justice type projects. So I had a pretty overarching political vision of what my political values were. But I had avoided the topic of Israel because I think in a very typical kind of way, for a family that grows up Jewish and with strong connections to Israel, my own family, my aunt in the Israeli terminology would say made Aliyah, so went up to Israel shortly after college herself, and my grandparents followed her there. So we went to Israel a lot when I was a child, and I had strong personal connections there, and then also just the way I was raised, which was not explicitly defined as Zionist, but Israel was so completely integrated into our worldview that it was integral to our Jewish experience and our family experience. Mm-hmm. So it was not very comfortable for me in my family to talk about any concerns I had about actions that I heard about Israel taking. So I'd sort of, I had a fight or two with my dad about when certain incidents happened. But I had sort of made a semi-conscious decision not to deal with the situation in Israel, just because it was harder in my family. And then what happened was the second Intifada started. I was with a friend in San Francisco who I actually had grown up with, who was also doing the same kind of work as I was in the housing world in San Francisco. And we both were thinking a lot about what was happening as the second Intifada was starting. I mean, I think it was actually a very similar moment to the one we just passed this summer, where a lot of mm-hmm. people are forced to think about these issues when they've been able to avoid them for a long time. We've seen mm-hmm. a very parallel process in the Jewish community this summer, as people have just been horrified by what happened in Gaza. And so suddenly they're sort of being forced to deal with it. So that's basically what happened to me mm-hmm. during the second Intifada, was that I just felt like I can't avoid this topic anymore. So this friend and I decided to give ourselves a sort of study group on the topic. And at the end of it, we joined JVP, which at the time, again, was a very small volunteer organization. And that was how I started doing this work. And I think it was actually quite easy because I had a set of values that I just felt like I need to be consistent about, that, mm-hmm. that if I cared about equality and if I cared about human rights, and if I cared about justice, and if I cared about also from a Jewish perspective, the values of pursuing justice and of treating your neighbors yourself and all those sorts of things, all of that only pointed to having to take a stand that what Israel was doing was wrong. And so it was very consistent with the other work I was doing. You know, it's a civil rights issue, it's a human rights issue, it's an issue of mm-hmm. equality. And I think that's also very much based in the fact of being and having grown up Jewish in the United States, and that I expect equality of citizenship as a Jewish person in this country. I expect mm-hmm. Full and equal rights. And so if I expect full and equal rights as a Jewish person in this country, then I can't, on the other hand, say, but in Israel, it's okay that it's structured a different way and that some people have less rights than others. Mm-hmm. So because I had that political framework, it was easy for me to slot it in. And then it was very, very liberating, I guess I would say, to be able to speak from a place of my own personal identity and my own personal experience in the Jewish community and with my connections to Israel to work for change in that arena as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I began my Palestine solidarity activism in 2005. And back then, Palestine was still very, very much a four-letter word in the Jewish community. You just didn't talk about it. Talk about how that has changed over the years since you began your work.
Well, I do remember, again, and this goes to your previous question where I just left off. I mean, I think the first time I did a public action in San Francisco, which was after the invasion of Jenin in 2002, we had T-shirts that say, Jews say, end the occupation now, or something. Mm-hmm. And again, I remember it felt like this incredibly brave thing to do, to wear this shirt in the street and be like really public and out about it. It felt like this huge step. And I also remember it got enormous amounts of attention because it was so such a non sequitur of what people expected to see. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of interesting because obviously there's an enormously larger amount of dissent in the Jewish community now, and it's much more common for, and I talk to people all the time who say, oh, when I started doing this York, there was no community to join. Like now, there's groups like JVP to join, and you can become part. You can feel a sense of identity and community once you make this move to these new to this new politics, and that's really really important for people that they feel like they can have a home and can go on a journey, because it's often a journey. You start out just questioning things a little bit, and it takes you farther and farther along. So I think that's really important for people to have a place to do that. And especially, I think for Jewish activists, it's important to have it in a to be able to have it in a place where we're not in the position of asking, for example, Palestinians to go through that journey with us, because there's really no reasons that Palestinians should be spending the time educating Jewish activists about why they have human rights. So, like, I think that's a place where it's really important for us as Jews to do the self-educating, so that we're not taking up the time and space of our allies and partners. You know, that's really, I think, not totally appropriate, and so that is a role that we play. But in any case, so it's become much more common, and the sort of meme of this, that the Jewish community is split on this issue, and that younger Jews especially don't support settlements at the very least, and don't think of Israel as a utopia and that sort of thing, that's definitely out there. At the same time, I do think that the level of suppression of discussion on the organized Jewish community level is stronger than ever. And I see that coming out of desperation. But I definitely see that there's less and less tolerance, you know, through very explicit guidelines. You know, for example, that Hillel International, which is an organization that was founded to promote Jewish life on campus, not to promote Israel on campus, to promote Jewish life on campus. And yet they have these guidelines that they're very explicit about that say that if there's a Jewish organization that supports boycott, divestment, sanctions, that organization is not welcome and those students are not welcome. So, you know, and I've heard interviews with leaders of Hillel who say, yes, we know we're going to lose some Jews because of that. And so they're like literally willfully cutting out of the organized Jewish community people who are questioning these politics of a state, you know, which is important to be said. So I think in that sense, that level of repression is or suppression is higher. But I see it as part of the evidence that we are making, that we're really scaring the organized Jewish community.
Yeah. And there are open Hillels now. I heard of like one or two where JVP activists are invited, right?
That's right. There's been a couple of campuses that have declared themselves open Hillels. And actually, there's going to be a conference at Harvard in October, this open Hillel conference, which is going to be, I'm sure, incredibly interesting. And I think that's a great, great example of the younger generation and the Jewish community just not accepting the restrictions on them, and at the same time the power of the small numbers of big donors who sort of control the way that these guidelines and organizations are allowing the limits of conversation is really intense, because that's a lot of what it's about, is that Open Hillel offers a lot of resources to campuses, and the places where Open Hillels have been declared so far, not coincidentally, are campuses where those Hillels get funding from the university, not from Hillel themselves. And so they're not looking at a big financial hit. So I think, you know, a big part of this battle is around the fact that you have these large organizations that are incredibly well-funded, usually by a relatively small number of wealthy donors who are using their wealth to dictate the terms of what the conversation can be in the Jewish community, and that people are rising up against that, and that, you know, that's where the battle lies right now.
So last week I was interviewing Jeff Halper, and he was telling me about a conversation he had with Barney Frank, who was a former member of the House of Representatives from Massachusetts. And Barney was telling Jeff that he was totally on board to support all these issues surrounding Palestinian freedom, but that if he publicly expressed that, he wouldn't get reelected. And he also said that if he got a petition of 5,000 members, 5,000 Jewish members of his district saying they supported Palestinian rights, that only then would he be willing to do anything. And this is really problematic in so many ways. I mean, it plays into the whole notion of Jewish money and power. What do you think about this, or do you or JVP have any strategies for addressing this imbalance in American society where politicians place more importance on Jewish voices?
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's a reflection of the whole corruption of the political system in this country, which is not limited to the Israel-Palestine issue. I mean, mm-hmm. politicians in general are incredibly motivated by their campaign donors. And what I was just saying about Open Hillel, to a certain extent, is paralleled in the political world, where small numbers of big donors can essentially outvote or negate the vote of of people's constituencies. Now, that being said, I do still think that the sort of grassroots power of constituencies can change, and just the overall development of social movements and changing understandings of issues can shift the political moment, right? So a good example of the way that's happened in recent times is the shift on gay marriage, mm-hmm. which happened remarkably quickly once the floodgates sort of opened.
Right.
And you needed, you know, there was an enormous amount of grassroots organizing that happened around that. And you know, what did have to happen was that constituents had to have the willingness to stand up and say that I'm going to vote on this issue. And there had to be a changing public understanding of the issue. And people had to know people who, you know, who saw this as a human rights issue and saw it as a personal issue. Mm-hmm. And a few politicians had to be brave, and then the rest were able to pile on. And so I can see and imagine something similar happening in the U.S. political world. I think part of what JVP does through our boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns is, and through the other work that we do with our rabbis, with our young people, is try to shift the public understanding of what is happening in Israel and Palestine, and that shift in the public understanding is a prerequisite for policy change. And so I think mm-hmm. we're still in this educational changing moment that will then allow policy change. And I do think that we are eventually going to, you know, if we're serious about political change, eventually that's going to have to go through Congress. And just like Congress, the U.S. Congress was the last to endorse, you know, boycotting the apartheid regime in South Africa, mm-hmm. the U.S. Congress is going to be the last to act when it comes to this issue. And so, you know, we can't expect Congress to be leaders on this. We have to be leaders. And I do think that we need to be willing to stand up and say that this is an issue that we care about, and that's how politicians make their decisions. It's through some mm-hmm. combination of their constituents' activism and their money donors. You know, on the question of the privilege of Jewish voices, I mean, I think when we do this work, especially work as Jews, when we're thinking about it, we need to think about the role that we're playing in this work and making sure that we are elevating the voices of Palestinian Americans, of Muslim Americans, of Arab Americans, and are aware of and actively fighting the forces of Islamophobia mm-hmm. That are so prevalent now that privilege Jewish voices over those other voices. And we try very hard to do that in our work at all times.
Yeah, you do.
And I also think... But I do also think that there's, you know, there's a balance between the pragmatism of saying, because we know that Congress people, for example, are going to pay attention to us, we can have an added value impact and we can help clear the way for other communities to be active on this issue. And unfortunately, because the reality is that accusations of anti-Semitism have often been used to stifle and muzzle debate on Israel in this country, that we are able to play a productive role in opening up spaces so that we can allow those policies to be changed. And so I think it would be irresponsible if we didn't, it'd both be irresponsible to not do that work, and it'd be irresponsible mm-hmm. to not do it in such a way that it was opening spaces for others as well.
So you mentioned about how the floodgates kind of opened, you know, kind of all at once for the gay rights issue. Well, not all at once. I mean, people it's an issue people were working on for years, but changes in the political system were very abrupt. And do you think this current war on Gaza might open the floodgates to this kind of like serious change?
It's maybe a little too early to tell. Mm-hmm. I was just talking to someone about this, and she said, look, it's a big ship to turn, but the arc has started. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the right metaphor and the right analysis of where we are. I do think things are shifting. I think they started shifting in Castled, and they continued to shift after the Mavi Marmara incident when the Turkish citizens and one Turkish-American citizen were killed in the boat that was trying to reach Gaza. And now with this assault on Gaza, this current assault, I do think things are changing significantly. I think it remains to be seen. It's just a little too close still mm-hmm. for us to know exactly what the impact is. But certainly, from my own experience at JVP, the enormous amount of growth we had over this summer just showed me that there
Today is
are
Monday, November.
People who have just reached their limit with allowing Israel to act with impunity and not resisting it. Mm-hmm. And so people are, the more that Israel acts in a way where they show no, where they're just absolutely out of control, I think the more it makes people willing to not just willing, but feel like it's necessary to stand up. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that's the process that we're in. And as Israel becomes more and more and more right wing, it looks less and less attractive to support.
So what kind of contact have either you or other members of JVP had with AIPAC or J Street? Have you had any memorable moments or funny moments, and have you been able to poach any of their members?
We ran a series of ads last year, 2 years ago, I guess, 2 years ago at the AIPAC, during the AIPAC conference in D.C., we ran these huge billboards in collaboration with the organization Avaz, which basically said, you know, we're young and we're Jewish and you don't speak for us, AIPAC. And they were in every single subway station in Washington, D.C. And, you know, AIPAC's policy is that they never respond directly to anyone. Mm-hmm. But we know from hearing from folks that really irritated them. but we have not had any, we don't have any formal interaction with AIPAC at all. We do protests at their events, but that's about it. In terms of J Street, it's a little bit different. There has always, I think, been an overlap in membership. We sometimes have said in the past that J Street is sort of the gateway drug mm-hmm. for folks who are first taking their first sort of tentative steps out into activism on this issue. So they often mm-hmm. start at J Street and end at JVP or continue on to JVP. And I think J Street this last summer with the Gaza assault and the fact that they supported Israel's actions was a real breaking point for a lot of people. And mm-hmm. again, the growth that we saw at JVP, I think a big part of that was the fact that we were the only Jewish organization that took an unequivocal stance against this war. And so a lot of people felt extremely betrayed by that, and that they needed to be in a place where there was unequivocal opposition to the war, and so came to us from J Street and other places that, mm-hmm. that weren't taking those positions. And so, and I think it's an indicator of J Street's decision that for them, a place at the Jewish organizational table is more important than, I hate to sound too judgy about it, but then taking a principled stand. Mm-hmm. And so that's the decision they've made in terms of their strategy. I think it's the wrong one. It's obviously not the one that we're taking. And time will tell. But I certainly, I saw J Street's, for example, Facebook likes flatline. They didn't increase in the least. It held steady at around 24,000 all summer long, while JVP's went from 57,000 to 190,000 over the course of that 6 week period. I think that, that says a lot.
Yeah, it does.
That says a lot. Yeah.
So do you think that here in the U.S. we need to continue with the letter writing and the petitions and the online activism, or do we need to move to more like on-the-ground activism, like blocking the boats, blocking the Israeli ships on a mass scale, which has already been going on in a couple of ports, or occupying buildings, as JVP members have done in the past? Are there any other tactics that are currently being brainstormed?
I mean, I'm very much of the let a thousand flowers bloom school, you know, that, like, do it all, you know, write petitions, write letters, have meetings with your congresspeople, block boats, occupy your congresspeople's offices, you know, say Kaddish at your Jewish at your local Jewish institution, do civil disobedience on the street in front of corporations that are complicit in the occupation, you know, everything. So I see it as we need to be creative, and we need to be as open to as many different kinds of activities. And different people want to be involved in different kinds of things and are able to be involved in different kinds of things. And the more options we offer and the more open we are in terms of tactics, the more we can get done.
So is the issue of changing school textbooks here in the U.S. something that's being addressed by JVP or other groups in the U.S.? And I mention this because I was speaking to Miko Pellad about this issue last week, and he said that his son's high school textbook, you know, is still telling the same narrative. The same narrative is what I learned when I was in high school in the 90s, which really gave me a very negative view of Palestinians. So is this an issue that anybody's working on?
It's a super interesting question. I've never been asked it before, and I actually know nothing about what is in the textbooks in the United States around Israel-Palestine. I actually myself don't remember learning about it in high school. I did actually go back this year to my high school, and I did a talk for the history teacher that I had in high school. I did talk to his class, and that was great that he invited me. JVP, you know, we actually are developing some curriculums. We're working closely with an organization called the Nakba Education Project, which is developing an amazing curriculum about the Nakba. It's in consultation with Zochrot, which is an Israeli organization that does education about the Nakba in Hebrew. And I think that's a really, really valuable educational tool. And we're sort of always joking about how someday we'll have the JVP summer camp and, you know, all that sort of thing. But as of right now, we're not doing anything particularly geared to high school students. And I don't actually know anyone who is. It'd be interesting to find out.
So tell us a little bit about why it's so hard for Jews to come out in support of Palestinian rights.
Well, there's a few things. First of all, and again, I mean, I don't want to overly simplify the story, because obviously there's many kinds of Jews who come from many kinds of backgrounds, and for some it's very easy. They grow up in leftist households, and there's no problem. And some people grow up Orthodox, and some people grow up Reform, and some people grow up secular, and some people grow up Mizrahi, and some people grow up Ashkenazi. And it's just a very, you know, there's lots of different stories. But I think the very common story, and certainly my story, is that we are brought up with Israel as one of the sort of, as a central tenet of religious practice. And I actually think, you know, I sort of joke a lot that what I remember from Hebrew school is like Israel Holocaust, Israel Holocaust, Israel Holocaust, that those were sort of the main things that we learned about in Hebrew school. And actually it was more the opposite. It's Holocaust, Israel, Holocaust, Israel. So the Holocaust happened, and then now we have Israel, which protects us from things like the Holocaust. And that is very deep and very psychological. And I think it's very unfortunate how central Israel as a state has become to Jewish practice, and I think it points to I don't know if poverty is the right word, but a sort of a thinness in Jewish culture and spirituality, in that rather than learning, you know, about the Torah in depth, or learning about Jewish ethics or Jewish social history in this country, or those sorts of things, that Israel has become the litmus test issue for what it means to be Jewish in the United States. And interestingly, we do see reflected, like a lot of our younger people who join JVP come out of a more active Jewish practice. Mm-hmm. And when they have an active Jewish practice, they need Israel less to be Jewish.
Interesting.
And I think if you're your connection to Judaism, you know, this is mostly about folks who are secular, if your connection to Judaism is feeling that Israel is your place or that you have some obligation to Israel or some connection or responsibility to Israel, then that's very hard to let go of. If you have an active Jewish practice where your Judaism is not rooted in the state but is rooted in Jewish texts and Jewish practice and Jewish community, mm-hmm. It's much, much easier to let go of it. So I think that's interesting. And, you know, so I think, you know, many of us grow up in communities that make this a very central part of our lives. And so stepping away from that is scary, mm-hmm. Because there is the potential for losing your community. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I think that's why JVP is so important, because, you know, if you can join a different community, one where you see your principles and values reflected, mm-hmm. then it's much less scary and much less hard. But if you speaking out on your principles and values means that you're going to be ostracized and have nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know a lot of people within JVP who left their synagogues and never went back to a synagogue. Mm-hmm.
They didn't find a new one?
No, because there aren't that many. Uh-huh. Or they just felt disgusted by the hypocrisy that they felt was coming out of the synagogues that they were in.
That's really tragic.
It is very tragic. It is very mm-hmm. tragic. And so, you know, I think that loss of community is real. Mm-hmm. That fear of loss of community, that fear of not having a home, you know, a spiritual home or mm-hmm. a cultural home is very real. And so in that sense, I think the fact that JVP is building communities like that, where people feel that they can have a Jewish practice and have political values and not have them be in opposition to one another is really, really important to offer people as they contemplate making that move.
Okay, so at this point, what kind of activism and support does JVP need most now from people to continue their work?
Well, it goes back to your last question. So people need to be willing to come out. I can't mm-hmm. tell you how often we have conversations with people saying, I love everything you do. I support everything you do. I just can't do this right now. I can't. I'll lose my position. I'll lose my influence. I'll lose my credibility. I'll lose my family, you know. And I don't want to minimize, you know, how hard that is or how scary that is mm-hmm. or how sometimes real that is. But I also would say that a lot of people do it. And they're much, and you know, it's a very rewarding experience, and it's a very and there is another community to jump to that's very fulfilling and meaningful to be a part of. But that's what we need, is the people who are on the fence, who know what's right. They mm-hmm. really do know what's right, and they know what they want to do based on the values that they hold. Mm-hmm. But they it's a question of making that leap. Mm-hmm. And we need to make it as easy as possible for them to make that leap.
So do you have like anonymous donors who, you know, they don't want to really come out, but they really want to support that kind
we
of
do.
Thing?
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Well, hopefully those people will be able to actually feel comfortable enough within the atmosphere that JVP's created in this country now to really step out. So, Rebecca, I want to thank you very much for our interview, and please continue doing all the great work that you're doing.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Palestine Solidarity Telesummit interview with Rebecca Vilcomerson. Go to jvp.org for more information about Jewish Voice for Peace. Go to katiemiranda.com or perhaps Vimeo.com. That's V as in Victor, I-M-E-O, Vimeo.com. Otherwise, KatieMiranda.com or JVP.org for more information. That does it. I'm sorry that I did not have an opportunity to finish the piece that my friend David from Morocco sent to me about the way the Ottawa federal government is handling their terrorist attack, jihadist attack, purportedly, a week or two ago in Ottawa. Was not able to finish that. No promises, though. Tune in again next Monday at 3 p.m. and, of course, Saturday, when I will begin an extended presentation of the history of Zionism. Saturday, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, 11 o'clock, here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting throughout the city of Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM and streaming live and free at freakradio.org. Thank you. Take care.